Esther chapter 4, verses 5 to 17. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destructions of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her, and he told her to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces show that for any man or woman who approaches a king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do you think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape? For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but what that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." This ends the reading. Sorry, that's all right. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. This ends reading, I think.
I'm so sorry, Ranjit. What a story. How awesome is this story? So if we're going through it, I could preach for about 6 weeks just on those passages. We have... We're looking at Persian culture and law, where, you know, particularly the king's wives were isolated from the rest of society. We've got this conversation between Mordecai and Esther happening through other people. We can talk about what that might look like. We can talk about the idea that poor Esther has not seen her husband for 30 days. If that was my husband and I hadn't seen him for 30 days... you can guarantee that things would be rocky. We go into this conversation where Esther hasn't heard the latest gossip, but Mordecai fills her in on the fact that all of her people are about to be annihilated. And Esther was oblivious. Mordecai challenges Esther by saying, if you don't do something about it, then God will choose somebody else. And don't you think you're getting away with anything? Your head will be on the chopping board as much as anybody else's. There's so many, you know, we could talk for a month on prayer and fasting. What are the purposes? What are the benefits? What are the challenges? But we're not going to do that today. We can talk about so much in Esther, but this particular line has been coming up over the last weeks with Karen and I for such a time as this. In 2002, I became pregnant, finally, after 8 years of no babies. And I wasn't well, but my heart was full and I was excited. I asked God for a vision of this child, for a name for this child, and he gave me the Noah story, which was really no help because I knew I was having a daughter. I'm thinking, Noah, the girl? That's not going to work. So through this time of being unwell and growing a child, I became even more unwell. And on the 1st of December, I started to look like Princess Fiona out of Shrek. I had no ankles. I'd already lost my waistline. I had no way that I could put rings on my fingers. I was full of fluid. I was not well. We travelled to Bathurst for Christmas and I saw doctors because my mum was so concerned. Sent me back home up north, jumped in the back of the car. And all I could think about was poor Mary travelling as a very pregnant woman into Bethlehem to give birth to Jesus. And it gave me a real affinity with the struggles that she had towards the end of her pregnancy and having to be moved around to a strange place. And at least I had a place to stay. I had a bathroom and I had a bedroom and I was loved and looked after by family. This baby was due to be born on the 16th of March. So the 1st of December when I swelled up, and Christmas was a long way from when she was due. I wasn't feeling well. Chris was studying in Brisbane. I was looking after the other children in the holidays. I was in such pain, hardly getting off the couch. I was not a very happy camper. I started to really doubt my faith, actually. All of me was drained. There was nothing left. Even the joy of being pregnant and expecting another baby had drained out of me. Chris came home from Brisbane. He'd been at an intensive. He walked in the door and he saw me and he said, "You're really not well, are you?" And I went, "No, I'm really not well. I've tried everything." And he said to me, "Why don't you phone Monica?" Monica was a very new Christian. She had come to the Lord maybe a few weeks beforehand, and she was one of those brilliant Christians who ask really tough questions, the ones that you can't respond with love, Jesus, and the Bible. She wanted to go deeper, and she was on fire for God. She was also a midwife. So Chris's suggestion to me to phone Monica had a lot of grounding. So I phoned Monica and I said to her, "I don't feel well. I have pain. I'm swollen." She asked me lots of questions. I complained a real lot. I told her what I'd done. I'd answered all her questions. And at the end of the phone call, she said to me, "You've done everything. You're... According to my midwife knowledge, you've done everything. There's nothing more you can do. So go to bed." So I put on my pajamas and I brushed my teeth and I went to bed and I started to snuggle in and the telephone rang. And it was Monica. And Monica said, "I don't feel right. There's something in my spirit that says something is wrong. I want you to go to the hospital." And I said, "I'm in my pajamas, I'm tired, I'm grumpy, I want to stay in bed." And she said to me, "I don't feel good, will you go to the hospital?" And I went, "Nah, I'll do it tomorrow." And she pushed and she said, "For me, will you go to the hospital?" So a pretty grumpy Jenny got up, threw on some clothes, drove herself to the local hospital in Tweed Heads, went to emergency, and I was not the friendliest person you would want to encounter. So a lovely person in emergency came up to me and triaged and said, "Oh, up you go to maternity. They can talk to you there. You're 32 weeks pregnant. We don't want you here. Go up there." So I headed up and I had my obs taken, and the midwife there said to me, "Do you want your baby today or tomorrow?" And I've gone, "I'm 32 weeks and I'm too tired to have a baby." Her initial question to me was, "So why are you here?" And I went, "I've got nothing better to do." So apparently I had something better to do that night. So I've been popped into a bed, given some drugs to strengthen Bubby's lungs, and had to be in touch with my husband because I've got the only car. I don't have pajamas, and there's a whole life going on outside of having a baby today. So that was all well and good. I didn't sleep. They kept taking my obs. They kept giving me drugs for the baby's lungs, and I kept getting grumpier and grumpier. At 9 o'clock the next morning, my husband got a lift into the hospital with his brother. He and my two children at that stage, they walked into the maternity room that I was in, gave me a kiss, and something went pop. The next minute, I'm in a pool of blood and everything is going crazy. They called a midwife in, or I called a midwife in, and she's taken one look and gone, "Oh dear." I've said to her, "No, surely everything's okay." She's gone, "Oh dear." So the upshot of it was that they popped me on a stretcher to go into theatre, and they brought my children and husband in to me. They said, "There's no hope for the baby. Kiss your mother goodbye. She's probably not going to make it." They went into a little room, had a glass of lemonade, prayed, and in very quick time, I wound up with this. So this is Olivia, named after the olive branch in the story of Noah. So she's the little baby that arrived at 32 weeks. She was 3 pound 11. She had started to bleed on her brain. The placenta erupted. She had no oxygen going into her system at all as I was bleeding out. They popped her just after this photograph. In behind her are the children saying goodbye to her. They popped her into some foil and waited for the retrieval team to take her to Brisbane. It just so happened that she had any hope of life because I was in the hospital that night and not at home, where I would have had no chance of an ambulance. It just so happened that I was on the same level as the operating theatre. It just so happened that there was a meeting next door of a paediatrician, an obstetrician and an anaesthetist, and that they could go straight across the hallway and prepare for the surgery. And so while my children prayed, we had Olivia Michelle delivered. We had to name her because she wasn't going to make it. We needed to give her a name so she wasn't just baby Clark. She was transported up to Brisbane, where she spent many, many weeks in intensive care, so a neonatal intensive care unit, where 32 babies are lined up beside each other. The monitors go all day and night. When they start to beep, the curtain comes around, the parents are called, the babies die and a new baby comes in. This is the kind of environment that she was born into. If not for Monica making that call of, "I don't feel good," if not for a meeting that just so happened to be happening on that floor with an anaesthetist, a paediatrician, and the guys there, I happened to have the only midwife in that hospital who had ever seen this happen before. And the outcome that time had not been good. This beautiful little girl of mine graduated 2 years ago. This is Olivia now. That's not her car. They told us that she would have brain damage, that she did have a turned eye, a turned foot, and she was the slowest of mine to learn to read. But God in his graciousness has restored all of that to her. She's in her second year of university, doing a double degree in business and arts, and thinks very, very nimbly. But the Esther in my story here, the Esther in my Olivia story, the for such a time as this, is not just Monica. not just the Christian, in this story. If I believe that God created us in his own image and God is at work in us, believer or pre-believer, God also worked through the people, the nurse, he worked through the doctors, he worked through that situation for good. I'm not sure either whether this was the only time that Monica or the nurse or the doctors were used by God for good. This was one of their times for such a time as this. I doubt that it was the only time. What about when Mordecai says to Esther, basically, if you don't do it, someone else will. If you don't do it, God will use someone else. Yet what a privilege it is when he chooses to use us. Part of what I do for fun is a disaster recovery chaplain. And when I did my training, I was told that the next time I would be required was probably going to be 3 years later for extra training, that very rarely did disaster chaplains get called out. Within a few weeks, I was called to the Lismore floods and my first deployment as a disaster chaplain. Over the next few years, I had been called out to 22 different evacuation and recovery centres. And the stories in those spaces, it's such a privilege to be used in those spaces. But I want to share one story. One time where, for me, I felt a little bit of Esther, where I feel that it was for such a time as this that God had called me to that place and that time. I was out at Drake, which is a tiny little town up north. This was not the first time that I'd been at an evacuation centre in Drake. These were not the first fires that had threatened Drake. On this particular day, my partner was another minister from the Lismore area, and we'd driven into town. This was probably my third day at this centre, and I'd based myself with my husband at the pub the previous days. But I had a new team member, and he was driving. He drove into Drake. I think the population is 200. Maybe 400, and there are at least 500 people in that area who don't exist. We often, as chaplains in disasters, work with people who don't exist. They don't have Medicare numbers, they don't have support networks, they certainly don't have insurance. So on this particular day, we're driving into town, and he chose to park in the pub car park, which was empty. And I didn't have time to take off my seatbelt before the publican came running out. This publican had an enormous reputation. In a previous fire in surrounding Drake, the town was ordered to evacuate. So 12 months beforehand, the town had been ordered to evacuate. And I'm in Inverell with my husband waiting for the influx of people that never came. So the town was ordered to evacuate, and the publican said, "Not me," and opened the doors. And the town evacuated to the pub where they were fed and housed as the crisis became manageable. In my mind, the publican was about 6 foot, walked like a bloke, and had been in the town for probably 50 years. The publican who came out to me on that day was shorter than me, half my age, and had been in the town for 1 month longer than the previous fire. She's a little dynamo. She raced out to the car and said, "I've been waiting for you." I thought, we haven't even properly met. "You've been waiting for me?" "Yes, that lady over there needs you." So I walked over to a lady who had seen more life than most of us in this room. She probably looked twice her age, had half her teeth, and was as grey as death. She's sitting in a little under a little awning in a chair, and she's struggling. My time in aged care set me to thinking she was having a heart attack. I gathered some information from her that probably confirmed to me that she needed urgent medical care. She and her partner, she hadn't left her property for 3 years. She had an existing heart condition which made it impossible for her to leave her property. She lived in the middle of nowhere with her partner and 26 dogs. The police had come the previous evening and asked them to leave, which they wouldn't, because they couldn't take the dogs. Because of her partner's diagnosis of a mental health issue and being known to the police exerted their authority and manually took them off the property, much to their disgust, and took them into Drake. They didn't know what was going on with the property, and they didn't have their medication. She didn't have her heart medication. She's as grey as Fran's jumper. She had spoken to the ambulance officers and they'd given her a tick of health, but there she sat. Without my aged care experience, I probably would have just sat there and held her hand, but something in me said, was it aged care experience? Was it a God move? But I was prompted to find some other ambos who were gracious enough to come over and to do some traces of her heart. And she was indeed having a heart attack. The ambulance at that stage is about an hour away. So we need to prepare her to get in an ambulance that's going to take at least an hour to get there. Her partner is not in a good place, but she would like him to go with her. He's a guy about as big as our doorway, both in height and width, and he's not happy. We've watched him confront the police as we've come into town and wondered what was going on. But when I go to look for him, he's over near the cafe, surrounded by people, and he's not very happy. I've gone over to him and said, your partner is about to go in an ambulance, and he said she can't. Your partner is about to go in an ambulance, and he's come chest to chest. She can't. If she goes in an ambulance, she'll die. If she stays here, sir, she will die. He's angry, and he's full of that anger is just spilling out, and he's in my face, all 5'2" of me. And all I can do is pray. His anger dissipates. And he follows me and packs a bag and we go back to his partner to prepare to get in the ambulance that is still half an hour away. As three burly cops come over because they want to protect me. Just gone, no, he's fine. No, he's fine. He goes with his partner when the ambulance arrives and we don't hear anything for a few weeks. My partner's there, my DRCN partner is there a few weeks later and he sees a guy parked by the side of the road in his car with a dog in the back seat. He pulls over and he says, I think that's the guy. Goes over to the guy and says, the big guy comes out, size of a mountain, gives him a big bear hug and says, if not for you, chaplains, my partner would be dead. She's had a triple bypass. She's in the hospital and will be coming home very soon. We go, coming home? Your house is saved? And he goes, no, my house is lost. But I have my car and I have two of my 26 dogs and that's a miracle. If you had not been here, if the chaplains had not been here, my wife would be dead. My partner would be dead. It was a good outcome. But I think there's more than one Esther in this story. I'd like to think that God used me in that space a little bit, but I also see how he used a couple of ambulance officers who just so happened to be sitting in a car park across the way. and just so happened to be gracious enough to recheck the observations on a lady that they could easily have forgotten. There are so many times when we look for one Esther, and in our story today there is one Esther, but what about Mordecai? If he hadn't done what he had done. I want you to look at stories in your life, and Karen's going to come up in a minute and share a story from this week as well, but to consider the story of Esther and how many of these things are transferable into our world. How many of these things do we see more often than we would expect?
Thank you, Jenny, for those stories. And just a reminder that we are all Esthers in some situations.